Asatyam pratishtam te. Jagat ahuranishvaram. Aparasparasambhutam. Kimanyat kamahaitukam. Asatyam pratishtam te. Jagadahuranishvaram. Aparasparasambhutam. Kimanyat kamahaitukam. Please chant. Asatyam apratishtam te jagat ahuranishvaram aparasparasambhutam kimanyat kamahaitukam asatyam apratishtam te Jagadahuranishvaram Aparasparasambhutam Kimanyatkamahaitukam Atajis Yes. If you would like to. Asatyam apratishtam te jagad ahuranishvaram aparasparasambhutam kimanyat kamahaitukam Word meanings. Asatyam, unreal. Apratishtam, without foundation. Te, they. Jagat, the cosmic manifestation. Ahuhu, say. Anishvaram, with no controller. Aparaspara, without cause. Sambhutam, arisen. Kim anyat, there is no other cause. Kama haitukam, it is due to lust only. Translation. I could get this away from the book. Okay, I think we got it. Translation. They say that this world is unreal, with no foundation, no God in control. They say it is produced of sex desire and has no cause other than lust. Purport. The demonic concludes that the world is phantasmagoria. There is no cause and effect, no controller, no purpose. Everything is unreal. They say that this cosmic manifestation arises due to chance material actions and reactions. They do not think that the world was created by God for a certain purpose. They have their own theory that the world has come about in its own way and that there is no reason to believe that there is a God behind it. For them, there is no difference between spirit and matter, and they do not accept the Supreme Spirit. Everything is matter only, and the whole cosmos is supposed to be a mass of ignorance. According to them, everything is void, and whatever manifestation exists is due to our ignorance in perception. They take it for granted that all manifestation is diversive. They take it for granted that all manifestation of diversity is a display of ignorance. Just as in a dream we may create so many things which actually have no existence. Then, when we're awake, we see that everything is simply a dream. But factually, although the demons say that life is a dream, they're very expert in enjoying this dream. And so, instead of acquiring knowledge, they become more and more implicated in their dreamland. They conclude that as a child is simply the result of sexual intercourse between a man and a woman, this world is born without any soul. For them, it is only a combination of matter that has produced the living entities, and there is no question of existence of the soul. As many living creatures come out from perspiration or from a dead body without any cause, the whole living world has come out of the material combinations of the cosmic manifestation. Therefore, material nature is the cause of the manifestation, and there is no other cause. You may want to reread that. They do not believe in the words of Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, Maya Adyakshina Prakriti Suyate Sacharacharam. That is, under my direction, the whole material world is moving. End quote. In other words, among the demons, there is no perfect knowledge of the creation of the world. Every one of them has some particular theory of his own. According to them, one interpretation of the scriptures is as good as another, for they do not believe in a standard understanding of the scriptural injunctions. Om Jnanati Mirandasya Ginanjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama Mukham Karati Vachalam Pangum Langati Kirim Yat Kripatamaham Bande Shri Gurum Dinataranam Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Asatyam apratishtam te jagadahura nishwaram aparaspara sambhutam kimanyat kamahaitukam. They say that this world is unreal, with no foundation, no God in control. They say it is produced of sex desire and has no cause other than lust. We should be cheering that Bhagavad Gita is actually a philosophical work. It is actually very interesting when you look at the history or the body of religion or a religion as a phenomena in the human society. How few of the scriptures within these traditions are actually philosophical by nature. For example, in the Bible, there's many books in the Bible. The only two books that are philosophical by nature. The book of Job. The book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastes, Propovednik. Only two books, and And the book of Job is not exactly serious philosophical work, whereas the book of Ecclesiastes, whereas the book of Ecclesiastes raises only one single question, just one question. It's a very important question, and it's an incredible book, definitely. But that's it. That's it. That's the extent of philosophy within the whole of the Bible. So Bhagavad Gita is purely philosophical work. It's a purely philosophical work, and in this section, instead of just calling names, how do you translate that? Instead of just calling names, kako si prema? Yeah, okay. Instead of just calling names, it actually philosophically explains phenomena. So in that way, in this chapter we have description of demonic nature, specifically the demonic nature as contrasted to the divine nature. But it's not just listed and called evil, but it's actually technically described. How is it evil? Without going to name any more scriptures without naming any religious traditions in the world or their scriptures, there are quite a few scriptures that demand from the reader who's expected to be a believer, demanding certain type of behavior and proscribing some other type of behavior without ever explaining as to what actually is the benefit of it and how that benefit is realized or actuated. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna does not do that. There is value, please don't get me wrong. There is value in simply demanding something from the audience. Srila Prabhupada also has done stuff like that. There is value to that, especially when we are addressing audience that does not have intellectual sophistication necessary to grasp the complexity of the abstract ideas. Good luck translating that sentence. Sorry. Feel sorry for you right now. And there are more to come like that. Maybe you should just record it and then deal with it afterwards. So if there is lack of required sophistication to grasp an aspect of reality, then it's better simply to tell a person, shut up and just do that. That's better than just giving them a chance to try to make a mess out of trying to relate to something which is unrelatable to them. So don't get me wrong, I understand value of that. But therefore, by just looking at the nature of the Bhagavad Gita, we can tell that this book is actually meant for Hare Krishna. That this book is actually, it's meant for everyone, of course, but it's specifically addressing people who are of a people a little more sophisticated in terms of their thought. So that's why we don't find, of course, Arjuna was a very sophisticated person. Traditionally in Vedic culture, Kshatriyas were very, very sophisticated, intellectually, morally, politically, even artistically. there's a great deal of sophistication. And so Arjuna was, even if we didn't know much about Arjuna, we could still, simply by the fact that he was a Kshatriya, we could know, deduce that Arjuna was a very sophisticated person. And so Krishna speaking to Arjuna, a very sophisticated person, just as it is a crime to throw a whole bunch of complexity and sophistication at a simple person, it is also a crime to throw a whole bunch of simplicity at someone like Arjuna. So, therefore, Krishna did not simply instruct Arjuna, you ought to do this, but he actually explained it to him. This is the problem, and this is how it works. And then at the end, he gave him the freedom of choice. He gave him the freedom of choice. Freedom of choice is taken away from beings who are incapable of making the right choice. But beings who are capable of making the right choice have to be given the freedom of their own choice. And it goes on proportionately. As more Hare Krishna. As more one's ability to make proper choices increases, more one gains freedom. And that is also true by the media of material energy. We see that the material energy conditions more those who are incapable of making right choices, to the point that their choice-making capacity is completely taken away. So even if they have an opinion on a matter, they cannot act on it because they're so covered over by what Krishna calls kama or lust. Of course, it's much more than lust because the English word lust is very narrow, but kama encompasses a broader spectrum of phenomena. So here, instead of just calling names, Krishna is actually giving Arjuna very fine philosophical concepts. And then after giving these concepts in the verses to come, pretty much rest of the chapter, Krishna explains the results of this one specific worldview. And so what is the worldview? That is the worldview of those who have demonic nature. I wonder if I will ever get to this verse, because there's another very important point. You know what? If there is time, I'll tell it at the end. Yeah. So what is the worldview that Krishna's pointing out to us here? It's actually not just one, but there are several different aspects. And to the extent we find ourselves sheltering these aspects within our own consciousness, to that extent we can understand that we have developed demonic nature. And this is, we're living in modern times where you cannot call the spade a spade. This is some unfortunate times. And of course it all comes from America. If you don't believe me, just search Americanization. So it's coming over here too. We're not allowed to speak the truth, yeah, because pleasantry is preferred to truth. But this is objectively demonic, even if we have it. Even if we have developed this nature, it's still demonic. Because the tendency in modern people is that if If I have it, then it cannot be demonic. And if I have it and you call it demonic, then something's wrong with you. But what if it is objectively demonic? So that's why Krishna is here explaining exactly what the worldview is. And then in the verses to follow, he explains why is that specifically demonic in terms of the results of that kind of mind frame. So first he said, asatyam. Asatyam, satya means traditionally in Vedic tradition, this word sat is contrasted to the word asat. So sat refers to everything that endures, and that which does not endure is asat. And so therefore also that which endures of course has reality, and that which does not endure has no reality. And so the word sat comes to mean that which has reality and therefore has substance. There's some substance to it, otherwise it has no substance. So typical demonic worldview tells you that this world is asatyam. Asatyam. That is temporary, which we don't say. Which actually Krishna says that we don't say, even though we say it a lot. But ultimately we don't say this world is temporary. We say it is real, but it is permanent also. Matter is also an energy of God, and it is permanent as much as other energies are. The only difference is that the material energy is in a constant flux. Promena. It is in a constant state of flux, but it is real, and it is eternal. In the introduction to Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada points that out, that matter is eternal. So they say it is temporary and that it is actually illusory. Why is it illusory? Now the second word comes to the aid. Apratishta. Sta means to stand. Sta means to stand. Pratistha means to stand really well. In other words, Pratistha means to stand really well, and apratistha means to not stand really well at all. It's just another way of saying that it does not stand. It's Prabhupada says it's without foundation. There is no foundation to it. And that makes it illusory. For example, we say Vedic philosophy teaches that I don't know if everyone here agrees, but I would assume so. Vedic thought says that, for example, in one body like your body, even though it's changing all the time, there's one thing that's constant. And because of that constant thing, there's some reality to it. There's reality to you. But they say that there is no foundation to it. It is constantly changing, and then at the end it just may not exist. Or in one point in time did not exist. Now why is this important? Because if it has no existence, real existence, everything's in a state of flux, means that there is no, there are no objective rules. In other words, all of the rules are merely subjective. In other words, all of the rules exist for some time, for some people, under some certain circumstances. In other words, if you can break those rules and avoid the circumstances in that particular given time, then you are not evil. And so people, literally modern people, live like this. They think, if I can do an act, commit an act, which is by the human choice, interpreted as evil, and if I can get away with it, it's all good. And so people have a license. They literally have a license in their own minds. They feel they have a license to commit evil as long as they can get away with it. Otherwise, if people understood that there are principles, that this world is actually, there is a foundation of this world that is constant, unviolatable, unchangeable, that you cannot change in any point in time. You cannot do anything to it. It's a law. They could never intrinsically feel that they have a license to violate it. But because they don't think so, they think that all of the rules are merely rules, not laws. They're merely rules made up by people. And so if I can avoid them, if I can bypass them, I'm good. But if they understand that actually goodness is not a human construct, that evil is not a human construct, but it's actually an objective reality that exists beyond my choice, it is always there, then they would never would they in their minds manifest a desire to commit evil. And if you examine human psychology, humans commit evil only when they don't think it's evil. Some people may call it evil, but they themselves don't consider it evil. Like, how do you tell a person to become a vegan or vegetarian or to stop torturing animals? You actually show the person that what he's doing is actually evil. Is this being recorded? It is. Just so I know if I can use names. It's streamed, okay. All right. Then I won't use names. But we have had so many experiences. I just had some hours ago that experience. Oops, I might have already said too much. When the conversation came to that point where a person had no more arguments, just had no more arguments for in defense of evil against the animals. And that person just got up from the table and left. Because the person was cornered. At that point, the person had to agree, yes, I'm evil, and therefore I will change my habits. Or I will simply ignore what you have said, and I will continue with my eating habits. My immoral eating habits. And so that's just the nature of the soul. As soon as the soul is brought to the point of understanding objective good and evil, the person cannot do it anymore. Cannot do the evil and has to do the good. Cannot ignore it. Hitler, right? He called Jewish people, he called them animals, and he said they did not have a soul. Whereas he was very kind to his dog or to, you know, German blonde children and with blue eyes. I think I was really out of his mind. Or a person who's what do they call him? Person who's so morally ill cannot even see cannot even comprehend that what he's doing is evil, but it just gives him fun, like killing people. Huh? Yeah, psychotic. Very good. They'll do. Psychotic, yeah. Just in English, they drop the P. They drop the first P. So it's psychotic, but it's spelled. Psychotic person. And as a matter of fact, if someone commits an evil and then is brought to the court of law, that's supposed to be the court of justice, but some other time about that, the dichotomy between law and justice. And if the person does not show remorse, then that person is always more heavily punished. Kept behind bars for a longer time. Because the person has not... The moral compass of that person is damaged. That person, what is evil, is incapable of perceiving that as evil. But as soon as the person develops ability to see, oh, that's evil, and as soon as he sees it as evil, cannot do it anymore. And all of this is packed in the first two words of Krishna's statement. Asatyam apratishtam te. Jagat ahur anishwaram. This is also very interesting. Well, first anishwaram, that this world has no, does not have an ishwaram, does not have an owner. I'm not sure. I think I might have told the story here last year. Because sometimes when I'm in the same place, then it triggers same thoughts, same memory. Anyhow, I was a child and I was on the beach with my parents together with the relatives from Polchani. And then I came back after a while. I found a big boat, a toy. It was quite big. So I was very excited. It was on the beach sitting unattended. And I brought it back. Then, of course, my parents, relatives, everyone got immediately upset. Where'd you get that? Because they didn't give me money to buy it. Where did I get it? And so I found it and immediately said, it's mine. I found it, it's mine. Because I knew what were they going to say. So they said, no, it's not yours. You have to return it where you found it. And I said, but there was no one around. It's mine. I said, no, you have to return it. And a big fight broke out. And then one of my relatives said, look at all these boats, because we were on the beach. And there were quite a few big yachts around. Look, all these big boats, and there's no one around. Shall we help ourselves to them? And so similarly, materialistic attitude is that everything is up for grabs. Everything is up for grabs. It is there for people to grab. It is up for grabs. I'm not sure if I even want to begin to attempt to explain this, because it's a big one. And it's actually quite interesting how few people understand the import of this. But it's very comprehensive. For example, the beginning, one of the... who can point out what the beginning is, but one of the solid beginnings in the on one's religious path, where actual intellectual growth is when person begins to sacrifice. When the person begins to sacrifice, every civilized person sacrifices. People who do not sacrifice are actually literally emotionally ill people. And so everyone has to sacrifice. Parents sacrifice, friends sacrifice, couples sacrifice. Sacrificing is just, it's a necessity of any emotionally healthy person. But the person is emotionally unhealthy, literally ill. Such a person does not sacrifice, but rather takes. lives to take, does not live to give, but it lives to take. And this is most of us, even when we come to the point of chanting Hare Krishna, or maybe even, we might have even managed to pass the couple of initiations in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, modern ISKCON tradition. But we may still have the mentality of I live to gain instead of I live to give. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna actually, when he speaks of sacrificing, he only eventually speaks of sacrificing for God or to God. He begins by promoting sacrifices to demigods, at least to someone. So that person is pulled out of his little selfish tiny world and pulled into a larger reality where it's not just me and my little universe, but there's a whole large universe. There are other living entities in this universe who are also claiming right to possession of matter. And then there is also the owner of matter, or owners or managers of matter, and then ultimately the owner of all energies. And so in this way, one begins first to live the life of respect, and then eventually, as Srila Prabhupada points out in one purport in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that duty leads to respect, respect to, actually duty and respect come together, and then eventually leads to love. But it all begins with sacrifice, and the person who thinks that this world and everything in it is simply up for grabs, has no owner. It's there for me to take. Such a person never comes to the point of love, and even if he shows some love, that's just very different degrees of perversion of love. Different degrees of perversion of love. But the Vedic understanding is that there is owner of everything. And so ultimately you don't own anything. Ultimately you're allowed to use things only for some time, which we can see practically in our lives. What is it that we can take? And what defines anything as our property? The fact that is within our grasp, if someone steals my phone from me, is it still my phone? And then the question arises, was it ever my phone? And what about at the point of death? As Srila Prabhupada pointed out, you come to this world naked and you leave it naked. And then the question, was anything ever yours? So this is a serious philosophical inconsistency. So obviously there's so many facts that point to two things. One thing, that we don't own anything. Not even this body, Prabhupada points out in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That sometimes people come, other people come, and enslave our body. And then the question is, this is in the story of Manigriva and Nala Kuvara. Because they were so interested in their bodies. And then the question is, well, what is this body that you're endeavoring so hard for? Who owns this body? We see that sometimes another person who's stronger or has a bigger gun, or more guns, or more of them, come and enslave this body. And then this body is then used for their ends, or for their own purposes. So who's the owner of the body? And then it's not Prabhupada, but it's actually, anyhow, it doesn't matter. But Prabhupada also says that. Then what about the fact that someone feeds this body? If someone else feeds this body, who is its owner? Like for, in the example of a child. In the example of a child, the child belongs to the parents to a certain extent. When I was a really naughty boy, then my parents had to use the ultimate line. As long as I pay bills in this house, you behave as I say. Oops, sorry. The ultimate parental threat. As long as I bring bread to the table, you listen to me. Etc. Et so obviously we're not even the owners of this. Who's the owner of the body? So two things. One thing points out, one suggests one thing very loudly. That is that nothing, literally nothing belongs to us. And the other is that things belong to God. That there is an owner. That there is an owner. And so this is the mentality of the demons. Anishwaram. There is no Ishwara, controller or the owner of stuff. And this is also another interesting word. Ahur. Ahu. This is just a Sanskrit way of saying they say. Like when people, when they come together and they say about something, they say blah, blah, blah. Or it is said, or it is understood. Ahu is just a Sanskrit way of saying that. So the demonic have a tendency to think that... Oh man, you know, I just went over time. Okay, you're all free to abandon the room. You have an obligation to the fellow devotee there, so you have to ask him. Oh, you have two of them. So you have directed the question to the wrong person. Another word, it's a compound word. In other words, it's made up of two words. Sambhutam. Bhus means to exist. Bhutam means to come into existence. Sambhutam means to assemble. Sam means together. Like samyak, samnyas also. Come together, like completely. Come together. Sambhutam literally means to assemble. Or come to existence. Aparaspara. Paraspara. Paraspara means... Para means other. Or beyond, or above, or other. In this specific case, other. So, other, other. No other, other. I know it makes no sense. But that's literally what it means. And it refers to other, other means that one thing causes another, and that other thing causes a third thing, and the third thing causes another thing, and like that. And they say that there is no such a thing. However, this obviously does not refer to the mechanistic nature of the universe. Because obviously everyone agrees that according to the mechanistic concept of the universe, every action has a reaction, which in turn creates another reaction, and off stuff goes. And in this way everything creates. But what they say is that there are no persons involved in this. That it's a merely mechanical process. It's a merely mechanical process. There is no living force. There is no consciousness. There is no volition. As a matter of fact, they even say that our consciousness is not our own volition. Our consciousness, our decision-making process is simply a reaction of what? Any neurologist in the room? No. Our decision-making process is a reaction of what? Of? No, the materialists. Of neurological electronic interaction in the brain. That's what they say. That all decisions we make is simply wiring in the brain. And that's it. It's not you. There is no person who has a volition. Volition. I don't know. Yeah. Making decisions out of your own will. They say that your will is merely a mechanical process of electronic phenomena in your brain. They literally say that. And that's again stimulated by something else. They even say that religious experiences, simply electronic interaction, electronic interactions in your brain. That's it. No person, that's the point. Yeah, that's what they say. And technically this is called reductionism, where you reduce a person to a mere pile of tiny particles. In other words, you don't have a person, it's just a pile. You're not a person, you're a pile of particles. You feel good about that? Don't laugh, they say that about you too. But what's interesting here, so in other words, you're not a person, you're just a pile of particles, literally tiny, tiny, tiny particles, subatomic particles. And these particles are interacting, and these particles have an illusion of existence, that I am a person. And this is the breeding grounds for all evil. There is no other cause for evil in the world. Like people say religion causes wars, or it's dumb as hell. It's not religion, it is actually lack of understanding of personality. As soon as we become aware of a person, that this is a person with likes and dislikes, with children, with friends, with relatives. If you're ever mad at someone, just study that person. Find out about that person's childhood, how that person grew up, what kind of difficulties person had to go through in life, and immediately you'll stop hating on that person. Because you have come to perceive that person as a person. And so as soon as you see anyone as not one, but a thing, then you have no issue being violent against the person. Because you're not thinking, I'm committing violence. Just like in the middle of nowhere. What's that big hill in Poinciana? Just for Boch. Hare Krishna. You have come just in time to ask questions. Right questions. Excuse my joking spirit. Life is bitter enough. If on boat a rock lands on a rock and smashes another rock, does anyone cry? Does anyone seek justice for the poor rock? Prabhupada gives this argument in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that if someone in a laboratory spills some chemicals, no one goes into a fit and cries, oh poor chemicals, and definitely does not have a ceremony called a funeral where they play music for the chemicals, etc., blah blah blah. in some countries at funerals they feed people and then they also serve alcohol, and then if people drink enough they can also get in fights at the funeral. Kusturica, yeah? He made a movie, something like that, right? Right? I just remember something like that from my teenage, seeing something like that. So similarly, if we conceive of other people not as people but as piles of chemicals, or a little more sophisticated pile of chemicals, a very complex biological machine, but nevertheless just a pile of chemicals, then we lose feeling, we lose respect, we become emotionally cold towards such beings. And so this is literally the root cause of all evil. And if this is not demonic, then what is? Think of any evil in the world, and almost I really cannot think of any other reason besides this, any other cause for evil besides this. I was a soldier. I was in combat, and I was in combat where people were shooting at me. It's quite an experience. And I saw people who were defending themselves from because they were attacked. And then later on, when they counterattacked, then they behaved like animals. And they were doing to those other people same things that they were blaming those other people for doing to them. They just stripped those people of all personality and just saw them as piles of chemicals that need to be dismantled. And you put a hole in the body with a bullet, and then the body does not work anymore. We have disposed of that body, of that one machine. Which is interesting, but you know, they felt very much persons when they were being attacked. It had nothing to do with religion. And it's not easy to realize it. And so what's very interesting about this is the word ahu. They say. In other words, they make this claim about the world. They even say that ultimately, because it's all just a bunch of chemicals, there is no objective morality. That morality is just a human construct. That they claim this. But none of them, none of these people who make these claims, not a single freaking one lives up to it. Follow? Lives according to that idea. Because as soon as injustice is being done to them, they immediately behave as persons and demand to be treated as persons. None of them live according to their own materialistic worldviews. None. And yet they maintain these insanely sick attitudes from which every single evil comes. And we can see that in our own lives, to the extent we have this kind of understanding, to that extent we're evil. And what's interesting in the commentary, Prabhupada, to the materialists, to the list of these demons, adds Mayavadis. Because they also say same thing, aparaspara sambhutam and anishvara. And they definitely say asatyam. that Mayavadi is literally say, this is not happening here. None of this is happening. This is, I don't know how much you have studied Mayavad, but Mayavad philosophy claims that none of this is happening. If it's not happening, why are you even saying it, you moron? Moron. Moron is something like a zombie. Debil, yeah. And so they have no and yet at the same time they speak about compassion or while saying that all this is illusion. They say that all this plurality that we're experiencing, that this is just hallucination of one consciousness. If you were to explain in a very simple way what Mayavad philosophy teaches, you could use the following example. And I think it was Madhavendra Puri. He used to spend time in Northern Europe. I don't know if he ever came to Slovenia. Madhavendra Puri? The scientist, right? Good buddy of mine. I think he gave me that example, or someone else, can't remember. But it's a good example. Imagine a brain in a jar in a laboratory. And in the jar there's some liquid, so the brain is alive. It's alive. And someone is stimulating that brain. It's poking it with a stick. And the way the stick is, the way the brain is being poked or stimulated, the brain hallucinates about it being many. It's on drugs. That's why they say that. Ultimately, there's just one consciousness, and this one consciousness is hallucinating that there are many units of consciousness. But it's actually not happening. That's what they say. Shri Shri Pancha Tattva Ki. And so that also means that within this world there is no good, there is no bad. It's all illusion. And so whether you kiss someone or whether you punch him, it makes no difference. It's all illusion. It's evil. Let alone the evil that does not take one to one's ultimate destination, the place of love of God. And then at the end, the last line is, Kim Anyat, what else? Anyat, other. Kim is a question. Kim Anyat, what else? Kama haitukam. Kama means, we usually translate that as lust, but it's actually more than lust. It's all types of selfish in there. It's all types of selfishness. Whatever form of selfishness manifests, that's called kama. Personal satisfaction. Hetu means cause. Means cause and also means reason. Because cause and reason are synonymous. It's just a very slight difference. Because often in English when we say cause, we think of something which has physically created something. But the reason is also a cause, but it's a very subtle, it's an abstract cause. I for reason have come here. And that reason was cause of me coming here. But it was an idea. I didn't come here because my muscles moved. I came here because I had a reason. So similarly, they say that this kama ahitukam, that the cause or reason for all this for everything. That kim anyat kama hetukam. What other reason or cause is besides selfishness? And in America, you can see these stickers. One who dies with most toys wins. That's the definition of life. And so literally materialists, they psychologically feel like that. That if I have accumulated enough of matter, then I'm successful. And if I have not, I have miserably failed in life. And if they have not accumulated certain amount of physical goods, they even feel ashamed to meet their high school buddies because they have somehow or other failed in life. The value of themselves has been depreciated. Depreciated. Yeah. You got that, right?
They are not depreciated.
No. No, depreciation of value is, it just means that the value is reducing. Yeah. Based on what? Based on the accumulation of physical possessions. I mean, they say Americans. You have to be really brain dead to believe that stuff. That they're going around helping people, spreading democracy and stuff. They have no interest in oil, right? Hare Krishna. So people's... what do you call them? Politicians, not in the sense that they're practicing politics, but they're studying politics. They're also called politicians. Politologue, yeah. Okay, what about English? Okay, we got it. Politologue. That's a Dalmatian version of the same word. They say that as the wars are being fought right now over oil, specifically resources of oil, or sources of oil, excuse me. So similarly, in the near future, same wars will be fought over sources of water. Slovenia has plenty of water. Too bad you guys joined the European Union. In one point, someone... I wish I could... I wish someone would mark these words down and then... When they do that, say, see, he said that. they're going to privatize the sources of water.
They are already trying.
Yeah. They are. In Slovenia? Yeah, there'll be privatization of water. I mean, there are places where they even privatize the rainfall. Yeah. Yeah. Just give us a year. We're working on it. Why? Because kim anyat kama haitukam. These people don't. If they don't do this, they will feel. They will feel. I'm falling apart. I'm a horrible, miserable failure. I have failed at life. I'm not real. I'm being destroyed because I don't own sources of water. Because I have not accumulated matter. This is complete insanity. Wars are fought for religious reasons. Yeah, right. It's complete insanity, whoever says that. Religious war simply means that one person or one group of people have created a corporation. And they have their own interests to protect, and that's it. And when they clash with the interests of other group, then there's fight. If you define that as religion, yeah, you're right. There are religious wars, but that's not religion. That's irreligion. That's why it's stated right here in the book. Whether it's religion, whether it's economic differences, cultural differences, you don't dress as me, get the hell out of here. Political differences, then definitely economic differences. Then even, and this is really primitive, these sport team fans. That's just as retarded as the retarder as the retarder gets. Yeah. It's the same psychology. And so, for all these reasons, and we could continue, for all these reasons, Krishna describes this as demonic. And so, to the extent we have these in our own character, to that extent, we should recognize ourselves to have developed a demonic worldview, demonic nature. So, if anyone has any questions or comments. Okay.
It's not connected to class, but regarding your new name, can you explain a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
The name yet, so.
Okay. Took me a while. Poor all of my relatives, you know, they got used to my, took them 10 years to get used to my brahmacharya name, and then what? Sannyasa names traditionally have three parts, sometimes two parts. My name is a typical traditional sannyasa name of three parts. And so three parts are sannyasa name itself, specific name, and a general name. So sannyasa name, there are 108 specific sannyasa names. So when you take sannyas, then you're given one of these standardized names. My name is Tirtha, Swami, Goswami, Govinda, Ashrama. What else is there? Prabhava. These are sannyasa names. So you get one of these names, and that's your sannyasa name. And then, so it, for me, it is Tirtha. And so in the case that there's some other tirthas around, then you add more, then you then you refer to other names, namely the specific names. So my specific name is Ananda, so it's Ananda Tirtha. So among different Tirthas, I'm Ananda Tirtha. And then the bhakti, it points out to the bhakti tradition, so you know that I'm not from, let's say, Mayavadi tradition, but then within bhakti tradition. For example, in ISKCON, most sannyasis have the name Swami. And so because there's so many Swamis, you have to call them by their specific names, in addition to the names, to their actual sannyasa name. Because if you were to say Swami, there'll be 20 of them turning heads. Which one? So you have to say, who was here recently, Swami, with the name Swami. No, his name is Goswami. Prahladananda, yeah. So his sannyasa name is Swami, his specific name is Prahladananda. So, and so traditionally you just call the sannyasi just by the sannyasa name. In my case, it'd be just Tirtha. In this one, it's a little bit difficult if your name is Swami, because there's so many Swamis, so you have to say which of the Swamis. And also, by tradition, you never address sannyasi without a title or an honorific. So therefore, you utter the name or you utter a title before the name, because Swami is also a title and a name. So then you say Swami Tirtha. And if you use an honorific goes after the name, like Maharaj. Then it goes Tirtha Maharaj. Like that. If you really want to spend half an hour to say, no, just Swami is also a title, so no need for honorific. Even though sometimes people put it all. Usually do that during Vyasa Puja or something where you really want to be far out. But otherwise you just say, or Tirtha Maharaj or Swami Tirtha. If you use Swami at the end, then that Swami is understood not to be the title but the name. So if you were to call me Tirtha Swami, then you would say that my name is Swami, but my name is not Swami, my name is Tirtha. That's why it goes before the name. Or you could use some other title like Goswami or Tridandi Goswami, as Prabhupada used for himself. Tridandi Goswami, Bhaktivedanta Swami. Srila Prabhupada's sannyasa name was Swami. Okay, did I manage to confuse everyone? Okay. Krantaraj, Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki. Ah, you made a mistake.